I like to say that I'm not nervous, but you all know better, so I'll kind of start out with the shaky voice syndrome that hopefully will quit shaking when I look around and see the Mildred and Vernie and Ben, who's from my home group in Atlanta, and as always, warm, friendly faces. I said, this is a first for me. I've shared with in Al-Anon fellowships, but never with a group of AAs, so I somehow feel that's like the big time. So, I also did a funny thing. When I was back to my room last night, I was writing notes, and I thought, you know, it's funny when you think you're not even going to remember your own life story. But that's part of being nervous, too, and hopefully it'll kind of pick up as I go along. One thing I do want to say at the outset, that all AA stories that I've ever heard have always ended on a happy note. They always end with sobriety, for the obvious reason that if there was no sobriety, there would be no AA talk. So I just think I should tell you up front that mine doesn't end that way. And if I could have written in a different ending, I would have. But one thing that kind of got me started on the notes was Bunny, because I guess we can look at different aspects of our life. And the one thing that I didn't realize until I thought about it last night was, as she was predisposed to being an alcoholic in childhood, I think I was predisposed to being an alcoholic's wife in childhood. Because I was the little kid that was really into guilt. I know at what an early age I started, because my dad was an alcoholic. Absolutely adored him at times, and also hated him at times. And I know I must have been about 6 years old, because it was right before my sister was born, when he was a bartender, and he used to work at the seashore. And we lived in the city at the time. We lived in New Jersey, and we were in Newark, and he was in Asbury Park. And I remember spilling salt one time, again, at this age of six, and throwing it over my shoulder and making a wish. And I wished that he wouldn't come home that weekend or that week. And it was funny, because he had a gallbladder attack, and he went to the hospital. And I thought, oh, my God, I put him there. And believed it for a long, long time. And the reason I didn't want him to come home, because he and my mother used to fight when they would drink. And I always believed that it was something that I did that made them fight. And that if I was, you know, could have been a better kid. Also thought that my mother, if she had done things differently, that they wouldn't fight, or that he wouldn't drink. So you see, I was really setting myself up to be a very good wife of an alcoholic. All through my childhood, as I remember it, that sort of was the pattern of him being gone a lot. Then he used to go to Florida, and he'd come home, and it always was the same thing, that I wanted to be a really good kid. And I was, even as a little kid, I was what they called a people pleaser. They'd say, oh, there's Geraldine. God, she's a nice little girl. And that was my aim in life, was just be a nice little girl, have everybody like me. And mostly I succeeded. And I guess I just, even I think this is something I brought into my adult life, that if I was in a room with 143 people and I could sense good feelings from 142 of them, I'd find that one and make friends. Think, you know, surely you're going to like me. I'll make you like me. And because this was my kind of sick need. And my dad died when I was 12. And he died, he was 46. And I have a lot of jumbled up memories. A lot of them that never really came into focus until I was grown up. One time I remember being sent, it was on a Sunday, and I rode my bicycle, I think from the time I was 7 years old till I was 18, I just rode all over town on my bike. People were always sending me on errands. But I remember this Sunday being sent down to a bar, because they didn't sell whiskey in New Jersey on Sunday, in liquor stores were closed, but you could buy it by the drink, to get a container of whiskey. And I can remember my dad being scared of the things that were on the wall, and which that frightened me. I had no idea at the time that he was in DTs. But he must have had a wise friend, because whoever sent me out for whiskey knew what they were doing. And I just pedaled back home with this. And these were all the kind of things that were part of my childhood that I kind of squished down. I didn't want to remember, because it just didn't seem like that wasn't the way everybody else on our block was living. But anyway, my dad died. And 46 even then was kind of young, and had no idea that the alcoholism had so much to do with it. We didn't have any money. I used to work, and but I did not have what you call an unhappy childhood. I just sort of chewed along. I was very much into unreality, and I was real good at living in a dream world, and so I can't say that my childhood was all that unhappy. It was not. But at the time that I met my husband, and of course I'd heard about him. He also lived around the shore. I knew him by reputation. He was in the Navy. And I want to say that I'm not meaning to tell his story, but the two are kind of intertwined, so a lot of it does come out. But anyway, he was in the Navy, and I used to hear stories about Hardy Bush and how wild he was. And, oh, he did this, and they always sounded like exciting stories. And I'd never seen him or never met him. He was called back in the Navy the second time around for Korea. And finally I met him one night in a bar, and it was love at first sight. We just were absolutely, I just was dating a real good friend of his, and that was the end of John Shane, because Hardy Bush was just the thing in my life. And we got drunk together, and we were just fun people. And part of our lifestyle was drinking, going to bars. It never seemed unusual. I met him in May, and we were married in September. And I never saw him for more than a weekend, because we were married the week he got out of the Navy. And prior to that, he just came home on weekends. And that didn't seem unusual, but, you know, that's as much as anybody has to know what good times we had together. And Hardy's parents were also alcoholic. And one of the things that we thought, we were different, that nobody was as much in love as we were, and that our life was going to be so different than our parents. And we'd talk about what good parents we were going to be, and, oh, just all this nifty stuff. And sure enough, we started out. We left New Jersey right after we were married. And Hardy's business was installing Dial central offices. When a town converted to Dial, he would go put the central office equipment in. And back then, there were a lot of independents, and so we lived in a lot of small towns. And any town that was not a bell town, we would be working in. It was like construction. So like Bunny, we moved a lot. And I think I even was ahead of her. I think our first 4 years, we moved 22 times. And maybe that's why Hardy drank. but we were the married couple on most of the jobs, so everybody always stopped over and, you know, would hang out at our place. And it was fun, because there was always something to drink. There were always lots of laughs. It was just still good times. Right? Even this early, though, it was sort of a funny feeling to me when I realized how, even though we always had plenty of booze at the house, Hardy didn't always come home right after work, you know, stop downtown with the guys. That once he had a drink, it was sort of, we'd go on into the night. And I was pregnant at that time, and I thought, well, that's just part of, he's scared because we're going to have a baby and all this stuff. I was made to order for making excuses. When they say that alcoholism is the only disease that has a built-in denial system, mine was stronger than his, because I didn't, more than anything in the world, I wanted a good marriage and have, you know, I was going to be a good mother. And So I couldn't even think that there might be something wrong with the marriage. So it had to be any number of other things. But anyway, we started early on. And the fact that, as I said, I never really associated the drinking with any of the problems in the marriage. I thought it must be me. So we went from all these towns. I'm trying to think of different stories in every one. I think things got a little... We went to Las Vegas. We lived there for 2 years. And, of course, there it was easy because I blamed the town. I mean, anybody who lived in Las Vegas would naturally stay out for days at a time drinking. It wasn't that you wanted to drink. It's just that the town made you do that. So that was a bad place for us. We were now expecting our second child. I remember Hardy promising, because I was scared, that he would... This was after several nights of being out. And he said, well, don't worry, I'll be home right after work tonight. And I believed him. I always believed him, and I know why, because he always meant it. He was never, you know, these weren't made-up stories. When he said it, he meant he would be home. And I remember getting so courageous. Since I was 8.5 months pregnant, I took the car and I left. I went all the way to, I think it was 20 miles away to Boulder, where the Boulder Dam was. And I just hid out overnight. And then I got feeling so guilty because I thought, poor Hardy, he'll be so worried. It isn't fair to him. I better go back. And I remember when I went back, I did know right where to go to find him, and he was in the bar next to the telephone office. And poor guy, he really was worried. When he realized I was gone, I had to tell him, because he had never gone home. So it was good that I relieved him of that worry. And so... That was the closest to a separation that we ever had, because I thought, well, I just probably have got to start looking better. And, of course, there again, I thought, well, it's because I was so pregnant. And then our son was born in Las Vegas, and we left shortly after that. And I thought, well, I was glad we were leaving that town, because that town had certainly messed up our lives. And we went to what was probably the complete antithesis of Las Vegas. It was a little town called Tonganoxie, Kansas. I don't suppose anyone here has ever heard of it. I hope not. Smallest town in the world. But we were renting a trailer there. And I remember a funny thing. Of course, I know there's not an alcoholic in the world that doesn't have some unbelievable stories to tell. But I have to share this one story of Hardy's, because it did seem that things like this always happened to him. Whenever I thought I had our life set up so that nothing could interfere, I kind of got to know the people that own the telephone company, because I thought that way I could be strolling by in the evening at 5 and maybe walk him home. Because I was determined that he wasn't going to hang out at the bar. But I remember one night, he didn't get home from work, and I was really in a panic, because we hadn't been in the town long enough for him to know anybody. And it used to take a week or so before he had best friends in the bars and stuff like that. And this time I was really scared. It was like 2 a.m, and I called the bar, and they said he had left like 6 hours ago, and I thought, oh, God, he's dead. So I called some friends, some other installers, and they came over, and they kind of figured he was dead, too, somewhere, but they couldn't figure out where, how he'd gotten between the telephone office and home. And it was funny. It was a snowy night, and his car, in truth, had gone off the road, and... as luck would have it, there was another car that had gone off the road right next to him, and it was an old drinking buddy who said, Mr. Collins, this guy, I had met him, and he was a really funny guy. I used to call everybody Hoss. And Hardy said, God, when I saw that car and I looked in, there he was with a fifth, and said, hi, Hoss. Said, he just settled in for the night, wasn't worried at all. So there they were. And I used to always think, this could only happen to him. But I said, I've been around AA long enough to know that somehow this happens to lots of people, or similar stories anyway. Well, so much for life in Tonganoxie, Kansas. At this point, I was into the going back to drinking with Hardy. I thought if I drink, then the typical Al-Anon thought, there won't be as much for him to drink, and then he won't get as drunk. God, I got sick. Because drinking really wasn't that much fun for me anymore. I had, you know, babies to take care of and other things to do, and it just didn't seem to be the fun that it was when we met. And Hardy didn't think I was as much fun as when we met either. And he was right. Because I was getting that, I always call it the look. They say in Al-Anon that you can tell an alcoholic quicker by looking at his wife than by him. And I think this is true. I had those, you know, the tight cords in the neck, and that nifty bit of following him around whenever we went someplace, knowing that if I had, you know, riveted my eyes on him, then he wouldn't drink. And of course, I was absolutely no match for him. Because if there was ever a time when if he were to say, who of us do you think is a little nutty, all eyes would have gone to me. Because I got so I was, you know, started to speak for him, like, you know, Hardy, you want to drink? No, he doesn't want to drink. Yes, he does want to drink. And people thought I was kind of a pain because I had become his spokesman and stuff like that. But we still had never ever addressed the problem. I mean, we had never talked about it, you know, to each other. It was just these weird symptoms of mine that were coming out more and more. After Tonganoxie, Hardy transferred into sales. He worked for ITT at that time. And he was the perfect traveling salesman. He loved traveling. He loved everything that went with it. He loved the conventions and the entertaining and all the fun stuff. We moved to a little town in southern Seymour, Indiana, which is midpoint between Indianapolis and Louisville. I thought now that we were going to have more money and we would be buying a house and we'd be settled down, that this meant everything would be fine. Of course, I was still deep into my denial thing, that there definitely was nothing wrong. Even though I didn't want to go on vacations, I was trying to curtail our social life because I just thought if we didn't go out so much or people didn't invite us out so much, then Hardy wouldn't drink so much. And then I could do something that would make things better in the marriage, because I still had this feeling that something was wrong, but I didn't know exactly what it was, except I knew it was with me. Of course, when Hardy started working as a traveling salesman and had an expense account, his drinking really got into high gear. And lots of times he wouldn't come home on weekends, or worse yet, he'd come home and he'd stop at the bar before he got to the house, and then he'd never make it home. And I would find this out from friends, and I'd say, oh, I saw Hardy at the Hoosier Grill last night, and I would pretend that I knew he was there. But it used to just kill me, because I thought, well, he's stopping there because he hates to come home, because I'm there. So I was into a... If there was any way to be completely lacking in self-esteem, I promise you I was. But anyway, that didn't seem all that unusual, because the guy that... He kind of started helping me with this, too, because I think he needed some excuses for himself, and one of them was that the house was messy. And he was right. The house was messy. So I became a compulsive cleaner. One of the things that we talk about in Al-Anon about the way a spouse will cope with the problem is through pills. Well, I never really took pills for the obvious reason. But another way is flight. And I went into a flight of volunteer work. If there was any organization in the town of Seymour, Indiana that needed somebody, and I was part of it, it was the everything in the church. I used to go to church every day. The PTA, the Girl Scouts, the Boy Scouts, or at that time the Cub Scouts, and the Girls Club, the Boys Club. I played in 3 bridge clubs. That was hard, too. It's a lot of bridge, even in Seymour, Indiana. I remember when we moved from Seymour, that I had to write 15 letters of resignation to various things. And of course, these were all the things where I was out getting my strokes, you know, making me feel that I was a person. But one of the things that I did, it was a group, And they used to collect samples from the the doctors all had just tons of free medicine. And of course, this is 16, 17, 18 years ago. So it was before there was a lot of talk about speed or pills or, you know, I don't think anybody knew. They called diet pills then, instead of speed. But anyway, our job was to collect these samples from the doctors and send them to the missions in Africa and stuff like that. And I was smart enough to know that those Indians that weren't eating enough didn't need diet pills. So I used to just stash a few of those because I found out that that's how I could really get the house clean, is if I would take a diet pill. I weighed 119 pounds then. I said, I have grown in the program. But anyway, in those days, it was good because that meant I could, when Hardy came home, he certainly could never say the house was dirty because I cleaned the inside of the vacuum cleaner after I would take these pills. And I truly, that was the only reason I took them, is so I could do a little bit more and have the kids a little bit shinier and have me a little bit shinier. And so I think there was a new reason then, after the house was always so clean. I think that was part of it too. He didn't like coming home to the house when it was like that. It didn't look lived in. So if I, at any given time when I was into getting off these diet pills, I said I could get back to my slovenly self. They didn't like that either. And but I thought, well, there's something. This became a time. Bunny said that alcoholic women had house coats. Well, spouses had house coats too. And I had a house coat that I'm sure was every bit as bad as that one with all the food all over it, because this was the time it became important to me that if he knew what he was doing to me, he wouldn't do it anymore. So it was important that I look pretty bad. And because I was in, my role was, I liked to meet him whenever he came in the door, which I never knew when that was going to be, but I watched for him. And when it would be late at night or early in the morning, I wore this house coat. I think what it had that Bunny's didn't was a safety pin, you know, that it was just with this big pin. Because if I looked good, that might, he might think that he hadn't ruined my life or something. And I was now wanting him to feel guilty, because I was so caught up in my own guilt that I thought, well, if he then feels bad about what he's done to me, then he's going to, everything will change. And I sometimes, you know, all the jokes about it's no wonder he drank. Well, being greeted at the door by this harridan, it's no wonder he drank. But I had at this time, a question that I used to like to ask him. And that's why I never liked to miss him coming home. I would like to then ask him why he drank. And I said, Hardy had more answers to this question. I still admire him because he came up with new ones each time. But I was just as taxed to come up with a new answers, because no matter what he said, I could handle it. And I was always, talk about insanity, because I knew eventually he was going to say the one thing that it was going to click. He was going to tell me what I needed to do, I was going to do it, and then everything was going to be great. But we had of course, I guess the big thing here was my feeling that he didn't love me anymore. And I think one of the painful aspects at this time was when we would go to parties, our sex life had kind of gone down the drain, but, you know, we'd be out and he'd be kind of being real affectionate. And I think, oh, boy, it'll be fun when we get home tonight. And I'd go to bed and he'd go down to the bar and drink all night. And this used to be kind of a heavy number. And I'd always think, well, if I had a black nightgown, maybe then, you know, or little knowing that there, I never was any competition for Jack Daniels in that black nightgown. And but I still was hanging in there and trying. Around 1963, the time of the Kennedy assassination, I remember as being a really tremendously sad time in our household. Maybe a lot of you were doing the same thing, glued to the TV and all that stuff. And at that same week, our next-door neighbor died, and his daughters were coming over to our house for Thanksgiving dinner. And I remember thinking how I dreaded that day, and I dreaded drinking and all that stuff. So I got an inspired idea. I asked Hardy not to drink that day. I said, let's just, you know, have dinner and not drink. I said, my God, Geraldine, of course I won't drink. You know, like, I thought, why didn't I think of that before? I never tried the direct approach. And he said, I, you know, wouldn't drink if you don't want me to. Fine. So I felt really good, you know, and got on with the day, and Joni and Janie Uckman were there. And it was a kind of sad day, but about 5 o'clock, I suddenly became aware that Hardy was just drunk as can be. And, of course, I came up with my standard question of why. And he really kind of took off on me. He said, anybody would drink who's married to you, and how do you think I get through that? And I agreed, because I thought, well, yeah, I guess that's right. But in the middle of this, he kind of broke down and cried, and he said, I think I drank because I'm an alcoholic. I really think I'm an alcoholic. And I said, no, you drink too much, but, you know, not an alcoholic. And, of course, I was kind of scared by what he said, and oh, heck, we each had a drink on that one. We sat there and thought, sat there and shook my head, and I thought, no, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I could live with the fact that he drank too much. So being the good and loving wife that I was, I then went to the movies, because I thought, it was kind of scary, and Hardy was acting differently. So I came home from the movies that Thanksgiving night in 1963, and there were some strange cars in the driveway. You know, I was kind of surprised, because I thought, who'd be out, you know, this time of night? And in Indiana, you could tell when people were from different counties by the license plate. And I knew it was cars I didn't know. So there were two men sitting at the kitchen table talking to Hardy, and they were from AA. God, AA, this was just like in Come Back, Little Sheba. My whole life was a series of movies. It was always like some movie. So we sat and talked, and I went to bed, and I thought, God, this is really weird. It turned out that Hardy, our next-door neighbor, had come over, and Hardy said, told him, I think I'm an alcoholic. And he said, God, for Christ's sake, Bush, you're the only person that doesn't know that. Of course you're an alcoholic. And they said, one of these days I'm going to do something about it. So they called Indianapolis, AA. It was an answering service, and these people had driven 50 miles on Thanksgiving night to come talk to Hardy. And that was really a shock to me. I couldn't imagine what they were going to be getting out of this. I thought they probably had, you know, another big dues-paying member that they were going to get, and that's probably the way they gathered them in. God, did I have a lot to learn. And so the next day, they talked about going to a meeting, and we had to go to drive about 30 miles to a little town called Salem, Indiana. And we went. The guy called the next day, and all that day, Hardy and I kept looking at each other like, what are we doing? And that night, we went to our first AA meeting, and it was like everybody's first AA meeting. It was pretty beautiful. The people were beautiful, and everybody. But I, dummy that I was, a really nice lady came up to me and said, would you like to come to the Al-Anon meeting? And I said, absolutely not. I didn't want to be in the auxiliary. I wanted to be with the big guys. And I just assumed that their job was that, you know, they just hung out and made the coffee and the cookies, because there was a bunch of good food there. And I thought I was already in enough coffee-making things that I didn't want to get into that. And I was real impressed with the AA meeting and the people. I said, Hardy and I both agreed that we always liked the people in bars. They always were the fun people. So we knew why we liked all these people. They were the same ones. But they weren't in the bars anymore. But I just thought everything that the guy, the speaker that night, said made sense. And there was a lot of identification. But because I didn't do anything as far as informing myself about alcoholism, I thought, well, that's that. Now that we've gone there, taking care of the drinking problem, we can just get on with our lives. And right after that, like within a month after that, Hardy got a promotion, and we moved to Chicago. And that was really heavy duty, because during this time he wasn't drinking, or he was just having an occasional martini, you know, which that wasn't like drinking. So, and I could accept that, because it wasn't the heavy drinking of before. So when we moved to Chicago, as I said, I had to write all these letters of resignation to a lot of organizations. And I didn't know that I kind of was giving up my support system there, because I really did have a lot of good friends in this little town. We lived there a long time. And I always had somebody to talk to, somebody to feel sorry for me, or somebody to tell me I was nifty, because how did I live with the problem? So when we got to Chicago, of course, Hardy, with the new job and quite a bit of pressure, really started drinking like he'd never drunk before. And I had nothing to fall back on. I started, what I did most of all when we first moved to Chicago was I stared into space and I rehearsed. I just had, every day was planned on when he would come home, I would say, and then he would say, and then we would go through, and then everything would be fine again. I thought about if he'd go to another one of those AA meetings, but I thought, no, he's already done that, so you know, we wouldn't have to do that again. So moving right along. But I did know there was something strange, because when they talk about a spouse withdrawing, I was really withdrawn to the point of I was really kind of strange. I knew I was in deep trouble. There were two things that happened. One, I couldn't wait to get the kids off to school so I could think. And I would just sit and stare and think and rehearse, and he'd say and I'd say. And that was my whole day until they got home. And then I was not into being a very good mother either, and I was not the drinking member. But I hated them around, because I didn't hate them around, but they did interfere with my plans for the evening, which would usually be at like 4 a.m., and I always had to be ready for that. When I knew I was in trouble, my oldest daughter, Leslie, our children were then 6, 8, and 10, and Leslie came home to tell me that the neighbor down the street had invited me to a Tupperware party. And I thought about it, and I knew I was not up to going. And I also knew that anybody that is not up to a Tupperware party is in deep trouble, because that's not the most demanding thing you ever do. And I thought, years later, I got really courageous in that I could refuse to go to Tupperware parties because I didn't want to, but I knew I could have handled it. And back then, I just knew I couldn't. I was afraid that somebody would ask me some question that I didn't want to answer. Like, maybe, why do you sit in your house and stare all day? But that concerned me a little bit. As I say, not that I wanted to go to the party, because I didn't. But my whole life was spent when Bunny talks about the obsession of hiding booze or hiding bottles. I think it's almost more tiring when you're the one that's hunting for the bottles, whether you're the hider or the hidee. It's either way, it's a terrible obsession. And I was very much into, at this time, poor Hardy, whenever he was around the house, I was always darting out of somewhere because I thought, I'll catch him. You know. And again, I was the insane one at this point, because I was so determined to either catch him taking a drink or catch him putting a bottle somewhere, and he was really kind of casual about it. And I can see where he thought I was a little strange, because he never knew what corner he was going to go around to find me. Ha ha, crutch again. But at this time, we lived about 30 miles from his office, and he had a telephone in his car. So we had a pattern, a very set pattern. He always called to say he was on his way home. And he would usually call from his car, so I had, you know, reason to believe he was on his way home. But he never made it. And part of the wonderful neurotic pattern is that he always called. I always said, dinner will be ready when you get here. He never got there, but I always did the same thing. And I used to like to wait dinner for about an hour, because the kids would really be hungry. And then I could let them know how their father was making them miserable by him holding up their dinner. And that was another problem. Frequently, the kids did not know that their father was making them miserable. So I had to remind them. And that was my job, and I did it well. You know, if Dad was home, then we could eat. At one point, I got up one day and I just was going to go in the closet to get clothes, and I did a funny thing. I just went in the closet and I closed the door. And that was scary because I thought, why do I want to stay? I really did. I just wanted to stay in there, and I didn't want to face the day. I didn't want to get into my thinking, which is, was my day. But I did. And I remember this was kind of a turning point in our life, because when Hardy called that night and said he was on his way home, and I believed him, and I measured how much I cared about him by how I watched for him and what I did. And of course, my pattern was every night to stand at the window, to smoke and drink coffee, and to watch for his car. And I was really kind of prided myself on the fact that I knew his headlights so well. I knew, I could tell them a couple of blocks away. Like, that was, you know, like, what do? I recognize headlights. And so this was the high point of my day at this time, because that's what I look forward to. So I could then ask the question, and he could then come up with an answer. He must have thought right about the same time as he made that turn, what am I going to tell her tonight? But this was a particularly important night, and this is something I've shared before. But when he came to the door, and it was really was late, it was like 4:30, quarter of five in the morning. I'd smoked cigarettes and drunk coffee all night and watched for the headlights. And when he came in, and I was there with my house coat with the pin and the question of why, he said, Geraldine, I'm going to tell you why. And I thought, well, this is it. This is finally, I was going to have the facts that I needed of why he drank so that I could then do whatever it was I was doing. Well, I said, I just loved him for this answer because I know where he had to reach to get it. He said, it's because you never make homemade bean soup. And he was right. I never had. I'd never. And I was just kind of, I don't know, I felt a sense of relief because I knew that this was the beginning of us really getting to the crux of the matter. But there was more. I knew there was more because this was serious stuff. He said, and you never play Dixieland records. And he was right again. I never had. So to say I was relieved puts it mildly. I thought, at last, I've got the facts. And these were two things that I knew I could handle. I could, I didn't want to because I didn't like homemade bean soup, but I thought I'll do it. And so the first night I made the bean soup, I thought, well, now that the problem is solved, and talk about insanity. And the records, I still have them. As a matter of fact, whenever I play that record, which I've kind of gotten to like, I always laugh because I thought, heck, it never did the job it's supposed to do. But two things, the insanity of me, because I genuinely, with all my heart, believed that that was going to do it. And the second thing is, I say, poor Hardy having to come up with all these answers. Because I know it was every bit as hard on him then as it was on me. But when that didn't work, which I believe that more than anything else, all the other things, maybe I didn't want to believe them, but I wanted to believe that that would do it. So I thought, it's time to take some kind of action. I went to the phone book and I called AA. And I called them much like you'd call a cleaning service. You know, you have the clothes picked up. I always want to say the dry cleaning service, because I certainly wanted them to come and dry them out. And the guy I talked to was really kind of funny. This has probably been said 100 times to an Al-Anon calling or to a spouse. Would they please come? And they said, no, but we'll give you a number to call. Classically, I said, no, you have it all wrong. It's not me, it's him. And I thought, I don't want to join those coffee drinkers or coffee makers, you know, the gang that waits on the alcoholic. So I just wanted them to come and clean up Hardy's act and get on with it. So, and this guy obviously knew he was talking to, he knew exactly what and who he was talking to. So about an hour later, this gal called and she said, I'll pick you up tonight. We'll go to a meeting. And I said, oh, okay. And as soon as I hung up, I thought, well, I'm not going to go. And then I realized I had no way to cancel the meeting because I didn't have a return phone call for her. So I thought all day about stuff I'd say when she came about why I couldn't go, because it was not going to be for me. But I was kind of scared. And this gal to this day is one of my best friends. I'll never forget. It was snowing, because it was now a year later. It was, again, November of 64, and the snow in Chicago was pretty high. And Roberta drove up in a Thunderbird at 90 miles an hour, and just, I thought, oh, my God, what have I gotten into? And they had a lot of home groups around Chicago, a lot of meetings in people's homes. And I felt real nervous sitting next to her, because I thought, boy, she doesn't know what I have been through. And my assumption was this about anybody in Al-Anon. They just didn't know, or they wouldn't know. And I was really going to dazzle them with my story. When we got to the house, it was a fairly decent-looking house, and I thought, maybe this isn't, what I wanted, because at this point, we were living pretty much like white trash in the way we fought and stuff like that. And I thought, these look like decent people. Although when we went into the house, I remember the first thing I saw was the phone was hanging off the wall just by the wires. And I thought, it looks okay. It's my kind of place. So I don't ever feel that I had instant growth in the Al-Anon program, but I know I instantly knew I was at home as soon as I heard some of the sharing and the fact that everybody there turned it into a first step meeting right away for me. I didn't know that at the time either, that so much love was extended. I was going to meetings morning, noon, and night, and always it was the first step. I still am into the first step. But then it was just all the beginning of letting go a lot of the guilt, the beginning of trying to get to know myself, which I had never done in my whole life, the friendships, of course, which were tremendous. But I just took as much as I could at that time. And I think the one thing I had to thank Al-Anon for right then was a good night's sleep. I never stood at the window again. And as a matter of fact, I used to kind of lie, and I'd laugh at myself. I was able to do that right on, early on, of how funny it must have been that I felt this need to stand at that window. And I think this was a little bit of a relief for Hardy not to have to greet me. One of the things that I also knew, at my very first meeting, I heard somebody say, there was a woman, and she had said to her daughter, she said, "Isn't it great that Dad doesn't drink anymore?" And the daughter said, "I don't remember Dad's drinking. I just remember your yelling." And this was, again, part of me looking at myself. One of the last things I did before, and there were many things after coming into Al-Anon, I said, In Al-Anon, we don't have birthdays, because there's really, our slips don't, you can't smell them on our breath, but there's lots of them. And I think maybe that's why we don't measure it from coming in. Because from the time I came to Al-Anon, I'd like to say I never, did any dumb things again, but I did. And one of them was, for some reason, I was still kind of hung up on Hardy's calling and saying he was coming home and still believing it. It took me a while to get over that. But it was my daughter's birthday. She was going to be six and or seven. And I remember having her birthday cake. And I said, "We'll wait till Dad gets home to cut your cake." And I can still see her asleep on the kitchen table next to the cake that we didn't cut, because this, again, was part of me making sure the kids knew that their father was the one that was making them miserable. And it took Al-Anon to point out to me that that was me. And that was a heavy number, because I really didn't like myself. And I didn't like looking at a lot of the things that I had done. But I was able to look at them, and I was able to make amends and do the best I could. The best I could at the time. And I hope a bell rings when the time is up. But anyway, those were the things that were, each thing that I felt I learned in Al-Anon, I considered growth in the program. And at this time, my husband went back to AA. I used to, through Al-Anon friends, AA kind of became my social life, and they had a Saturday night meeting up there. And which I went to and really enjoyed it. It was really great. At this time, Hardy started going to AA. And it was funny because a lot of people thought that I was the AA and he was the Al-Anon. Because they said, well, it's nice your husband supports you. I said, yeah. And things started to do pretty well there. And then we moved again. We moved to Minneapolis. And the move to Minneapolis wasn't hard for me at all because now I had Al-Anon. And that was a kind of welcome wagon that was just fantastic. Because I didn't go, I wasn't into staring anymore. I had friends and called them. And Minnesota had some wonderful Al-Anon, as did Illinois and Indiana and every place else. Because of the Al-Anon program, I was able to let go. I very much had a life of my own. We never waited any more meals. The kids never missed any more birthday parties, or we went on a lot of picnics and did all the fun things that I used to deprive them of because their father drank. And sometimes he was there and sometimes he wasn't. A really bad move, I felt was going to be a bad move, was Atlanta. He hated the North, and of course his territory was the Dakotas and Montana, Minnesota and Wisconsin, so it was kind of cold country. But we had a really nice setup there. The kids had horses, and my son played ice hockey, and we were pretty much into everything. And above all, me with Al-Anon. Again, like Bunny with her friends in Houston, I was really, these were warm, loving friends, and I dreaded leaving them. But Hardy told the old salesman's joke about the salesman that died, and he looked so bad when his friends went to see him. They said to his wife, God, he looks bad. What did he have? She said, North and South Dakota. So we got the message that he really did want to come south. So we came to Atlanta and just hated it. Couldn't have come with a worse attitude. I was just determined that we weren't going to like it, and the kids were determined. And it was a self-fulfilling prophecy. We did not like it. And at this point, I was not going to bother with Al-Anon because I had tried all that. Nothing had changed in our lives. This was me sort of sliding back. And we moved here in June, and I think it was almost the end of August before I called Al-Anon. And oh, God, what a miserable summer. How I made it a miserable summer. And I finally called the NABA Club in Atlanta, and Dot Hubbard answered the phone, and I was sort of like, an old friend. I'd never met her, but she instantly was an old friend because it was that warm welcome of, told me what night there was a meeting. And as soon as I went back to Al-Anon and started getting my own act together, Atlanta became a beautiful place, and I noticed it was not all bad. We had lots of ups and downs. Put it mildly. Again, there was no long-term sobriety. There was some jail time. It was kind of rough. There was an automobile accident involving a fatality Christmas week, which was real heavy duty for the family. I said one thing when they say that the alcoholic can't remember and the spouse never forgets, I think this is true, because I had the worst kind of mind for trivia. I could remember right to the minute when anything ever happened. And that can be kind of painful, because I also found out what the word resentment, which meant to refeel. And I was very good at refeeling old hurts. And this was around the time when I like to think my program took a giant step forward. I did try to grow in the program. And like they say in AA, you do what you can at the time. And I just literally was able to let go of Hardy's drinking problem. And this was the time, I remember somebody saying to me, and I took it as a super compliment, they said, are you sure your husband's an alcoholic? Because you sure laugh a lot. And I thought that was my idea of a success story for me. And as I said, around AA, it was always kind of funny because somebody would say, how you doing? And I'd say, oh, I'm great. And I thought your husband was drinking. He is, but I'm great. And so I say, I count this story as not your standard AA story, where there's because I always did dream of that, that we would be riding off into the sunset together, sober and all this good stuff. At this time, Hardy and I are not even together, which for now, that's the way it needs to be. He still, you know, feels the choice is his, and he chooses to drink. And I have as much love for him as I ever have. And I'm detached, not just from the problem, of course, but from him. But without Al-Anon, I could never do it without bitterness or without hatred, as I say. And I have nothing but good feelings and high hopes, because it's only been 17 years. And one thing we do have in the program is hope. And that's what I've gotten from it. Because with all the levity and everything else, Al-Anon has been my life. And I thank you.